Northern Brewer is the proud sponsor of the Brewing Network's Jameel Show. They have the widest selection of domestic and imported malts and grain, hops from all over the world, and a full line of liquid and dry yeast. No matter what style of beer you're brewing, Northern Brewer has the ingredients you need, plus fast shipping and expert staff to help you make the best beer possible. Please visit northernbrewer.com for all things homebrew. Network is proud to present Beer Radio that turns ordinary homebrew into award-winning beer. The Jameel Show. And now, your hosts, Jameel Zainasheff and John Plisse.
Got my head checked.
Hey, howdy, hey, my brewing brothers and sisters.
Woohoo!
Here we are. It's our second to the last show.
Second to last.
Yeah.
We're not there yet.
No. So this is going to still be a quality show.
Yeah.
We're just going to start screwing up when it comes to the last show.
Professional all the way through.
This one is still going to be really good. We have a guest that we're going to bring on, Ken Schramm, who's actually very knowledgeable in meads.
Nice.
Wrote probably the Bible of the mead maker.
Okay.
The complete
That's
mead
a good
maker.
Book.
Yeah, it's an excellent book. I got a great story to tell you about that. But, you know, we just had Thanksgiving.
Yeah, happy Turkey Day.
Yeah, just a few days ago, right?
Yeah, I'm still full. You? You look
like it. Yeah, oh, yeah. Well, thank you. I have been putting on a few pounds.
I think I
took in, 10 pounds of food and passed at least, a good 8-pounder.
Yeah. Oh, you passed an 8-pounder.
Yeah.
That burns. I hate how I feel after I eat so much. I just have like 3 or 4 Tums just to kind of like, just hold on.
And you hold on to the chair like that?
It's shaking.
That kind of
absolutely
grimace on your face.
Grimace, yeah.
Describing things here for the listeners.
I'm giving you a visual here, yeah. So did you spend with your family and in-laws?
Yeah. And what's great was usually it's me, the kids, my wife, and my mother-in-law. And I cook like a 25-pound turkey, and I watch
a lot of
TV.
Meat.
Yeah, watch TV. I watch my, my football games.
Yeah.
I get my drink on privately.
Absolutely.
And then after we eat, I fall unconscious on the floor, and then
what happened to Dad?
I sleep for like 8 hours while everybody else cleans up.
Perfect.
And my wife drives my mother-in-law back home.
Even better.
This time my sister and her boyfriend came up.
Nice.
And her boyfriend's this great guy named Ace.
Okay. Ooh, good name.
He's great. He's so fun.
Yeah.
Did
he drink with you?
Privately. Oh, yeah. I mean, this guy can put it away.
Oh, yeah. He was getting spoiled then.
He'll do like, 5 to my 1.
Oh, jeez.
And, totally in control. And I've been brewing the last few months, been way too busy with work. Right. So I went down, I got a keg of Bear Republic Racer 5.
Ooh.
Down at the BevMo.
That'll hit you hard.
It's like 7% alcohol.
Yeah.
And I hooked that up so he'd have plenty of beer to drink. And he and I went to town on that, and we played on the Wii.
Oh, you played bowling? Did you bowl?
Oh, yeah, a little bit of everything.
Okay.
Although, for boxing, my one daughter, she can beat anybody.
Oh,
I don't care who it is. She'd take him down.
Awesome.
And he's like, well, I'm pretty good on the Wii boxing. And she, he got her down once, but
after
she
that,
pretty much won, It took
she adjusted
around.
A little bit.
Oh,
yeah.
She's really good.
Played Wii. Did you play Wii Golf, too? And
yeah.
You drink the whole
Wii Golf's okay. No.
No.
But we put a pretty serious dent in it.
Wow.
And I'm in the process of getting rid of the rest of it, just, so I can return the keg.
So his name was Ace?
Ace.
Yeah, awesome. Did he know he was drinking Ace quality beer?
Yeah. Well, he's come up and had my beers before, and then, the cool thing was that he just enjoys good craft beer.
Awesome.
And something like that you know, it's right up his alley. So,
so you got, he's got the brother's approval.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
There you go.
Yeah. But, he's a lot of fun. We had a good old time.
Nice.
Beer, the Wii, some turkey.
Football.
Family. Yeah. Did all that stuff.
Yeah.
Perfect Thanksgiving for
we're
me.
Still riding that high right now, aren't we?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Going strong. Brew strong. Yeah.
And you and the wife, you went over to the in-laws, or
actually we stayed here at my family's house.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Her family came up and stayed. We had it together first time. Both families got the
in-laws
hang out.
Together.
All of them together.
Oh,
it was
wow.
Great. Probably one of the best Thanksgiving I've had in the last 10 years.
Really? And yeah. There was no fighting.
No fighting.
No bloodletting.
It was 7 hours of nonstop talking. Like we were always just in the same room, all of us just engaging and talking.
Well, that's what I love. 7 hours of nonstop talking with the in-laws.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, that sounds joyous.
Yeah, it was fun. It was good. Well, her family had like a leak in the refrigerator, so they have like $20,000 worth of repairs to do on their flooring.
Wow.
Yeah, and so they came up.
Yeah, usually around here, when somebody's talking about a leak in the refrigerator, somebody peed in the refrigerator. Is what you mean?
It has happened in here, I believe. So.
Yeah.
I can still smell it. Justin's just like, No, it's a good time. I think this Thanksgiving had a lot of more meaning to it, I think, just what's going on in the world and economy and stuff. And,
well, because now you got family
and
you know, your
wife.
And, like, you know, yeah. You're starting your own family.
Hell yeah.
Eventually there will be a bunch of little
Johnnies running around.
Love Strong.
Love Strong.
Coming soon.
Love Strong.
Love Strong.
Ooh, you got that nice little baritone voice there.
All right.
Okay. Focus.
So, again, I wanted this Mead Show to be a good one because we've got a great guest on the line here, Ken Schramm. Ken, you there?
Yes, I am.
There he is.
All right. Yeah. Ken is author of Complete Mead Maker, right?
That is true.
Okay. And that book, all right, so I'm at the NHC in, I think it was Orlando, and this guy, Kurt Stock, wins Mead Maker of the Year.
Oh, yeah,
right?
Uh-huh.
And I run into him and his wife in the airport, and a long time before our flights, and so we sit down, we're chatting, talking. I'm like, you know, hey, you know, how do you, what's your secret on the meads and all that? He says, well, you know, he says, I got a copy of Ken's book. And he says, I just followed what Ken said, and I won Mead Maker of the Year.
There, wow.
And I'm like, okay, I need a copy of this book.
Yeah, that's a great story. I heard that, too. And when I finally talked to Kurt, I said, man, Kurt, if this is true, you got to, like, put that on Amazon for me.
Right.
There you go.
And it is now.
Yeah,
finally.
Absolutely true.
Well, I'm flattered. Kurt's a modest guy though, and he doesn't take enough credit for his own skill.
But I think, you know, it's absolutely true. He read the book and followed what you were saying in the book, and that really made all the difference. And that's all he really needed. So I don't think he was applying anything other than probably good sanitation, ability to follow instructions. Read. The ability to read, things like that.
Yeah.
And he
does make some spectacular meads. I had the good fortune to judge the club only, the AHA club only, this past August in Minneapolis with both of the clubs from Minneapolis and St. Paul. And a trip to Kurt's basement is not to be underestimated. It's a great place to while away an evening.
Well, I think again, the fundamentals that he's learned are all based on what he learned from your book. So that's a great tribute to your book. So anybody contemplating making meads,
just get the book.
You go ahead and get the book.
Yeah.
And I think out of you many tens of thousands of listeners out there, go out and buy this book. And make yourself a couple of meads. I think you'll be surprised when I think mead gets a bad rap.
Oh, yeah.
When it's not properly made. It ends up, syrupy and just kind of nasty. And when it's made right, it's so drinkable and so
wine-like.
Yeah, so. You can drink a lot of mead.
Mm-hmm.
You get in trouble if you drink a lot of mead, but you can drink a lot of mead when it's really well made. It's such an easy drinking thing of beauty.
Hmm. Hey Ken, I'm curious, how long did it take you to write this book? I mean, meat takes a fair amount of time to ferment. I mean, geez, all this research you had to do probably to write this book. Must have taken a while.
It was in progress for probably the better part of 5 years.
Wow. It's been like the time.
It happened in fits and starts. We had originally I was going to write the book with a guy named Dan McConnell, who is a PhD microbiologist working in research for the University of Michigan, and he's a brilliant man, too good at what he does to actually spend much time on his hobbies.
Okay.
He said, Ken, why don't you just go ahead and finish the book? And I did. I did it on my own. It's kind of a bit of a shame because he's so brilliant and knows the microbiology so well. But what we set out to do was to write a book that was going to become the new current reference text on mead. There really wasn't a good broad-based I hate to use the term Bible of mead making.
That's true. Yeah.
But there were books from England and books from the book from Roger Morse on brewing mead, and then Wassail and Mazers of Mead, which was the book that Charlie added some to. It was essentially written by Lieutenant Colonel Robert Geyer, and none of them had a really comprehensive look at the subject of mead making and covered all of the styles and a lot of the subcontext that needed to be explained to get people into to making really high quality meads. So I spent a lot of time researching the aspects of especially fruit and spices.
Mm-hmm.
To help people understand how to make better melomels and metheglins. And in fact, in the course of writing the book, I was also learning to become an orchardist and learning to graft and ended up with about 18 trees in my backyard and raspberries and currants and all kinds of other things that helped me to have a firsthand understanding of which varieties of fruit were good and how much of a contribution really high quality ingredients could make to a great mead.
Wow.
All right. So off track here, but all right, so if you were to plant fruit trees,
yeah,
in support of mead making, what would you pick what's your top 3 types of fruit trees that you would plant?
Well, I'm in Michigan. And Michigan grows some of the Michigan is in fact the largest tart cherry producer, and I did plant tart cherries. I supplemented the trees that were here with more tart cherries. I've also planted plums. I'm not as fond at this point of making mead with my plums as I am of just eating them. I would say tart cherries. Peaches would be good.
Okay.
Pears are good. They're hard to deal with. I don't have pears myself. I'm just not as huge of a pear fan. And apples is one area where you can make just a huge difference in a cider.
Yeah.
And in fact, in ciders, just straight up ciders, hard ciders and sweet ciders, by varietal selection. So I would probably pick myself in Michigan, plums. Or pardon me, peaches, tart cherries, and apples.
Okay. Is there a point?
But a lot of it's going to have to do if this is going out to folks all across North America.
Yeah.
The most important thing to do is to research what fruits grow extremely well in your area.
Okay.
And then make your decision based on that, because that's really what I'm about right now is picking out your opportunity to grow something of the highest possible quality in your region, and that's what you want.
In Mendocino, that would be weed.
Quality in, quality out.
In Mendocino, you know what you're growing there.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
The cousin. Yes.
Right.
Well, you mentioned, so cherries, peaches, and apples grow well in your regions.
Yes.
What about, when you go out to your yard, when do you decide you're going to pick them based on the ripeness? I mean, I think that has a pretty big flavor impact on your mead blended with fruit, right?
Absolutely. And I do it by taste.
It's all by taste.
You can do it with refractometers.
Right.
And try and pick based on sugar contents, and you can also do assessments of acidity. But after a while, there's no substitute for knowing exactly what it's supposed to taste like when it's going to be ready. And I've had about 10 years of experience with that now, and I essentially just go out and taste until they're right. There are a lot of visual cues for the various fruits, but much of it comes from tasting.
Let your taste buds lead you. Mm-hmm. All right, so you mentioned the styles of mead. I guess there's traditional mead. There's piment. There's metheglin. There's melomel. And we're going to cover those today. John, why don't you give us a quick rundown on the mead styles? Kind of give us a quick description.
Okay. Well, I'll make it pretty quick. I mean, there's a lot here to cover. Definitely reference the BJCP.org site, I mean, to really go into more depth here on all the different types of aspects of mead. A dry mead, definitely, we'll start there. It's very subtle in honey aroma. It's not always identifiable, like the actual honey flavor. There should be some sweetness, but it's relatively dry. One thing to keep in mind with most meads is there's definitely like three ranges when you submit them into competitions. There's hydromel, there's standard, and there's sack. Hydromel is the lightest, standard's the medium, sack's the highest in alcohol. Secondly, there's semi-sweet mead, like it says, semi-sweet, definitely some more sweetness coming across, slightly dry, but definitely some lingering sweetness there from the honey. There's also sweet mead, which tends to be obviously sweet, usually expresses a lot more of the honey character coming through. You should definitely get the honey varietal coming through on the flavor and in the aromas. In regards, there's also a cider, which is actually a blend of cider and honey. Interesting, and I think this will be fun to talk about later. We're trying to kill. This is fun. It tends to have. You can use either three of the mead ranges. The standard, the semi, or the over the top sweet meads, and blend them with a cider back, or you can ferment them together. That's one idea. Piment is honey and wine grapes. You can use either white grapes like a Gewurztraminer Demeanor or a Sauvignon Blanc. You can even use red wine grapes if you wanted to. But really, I think what's interesting about all these types of flavors and with mead and blending them with other like cider or fruit is there's so many options here. And there are really no rules. I think the trick is overall it's just making a very balanced beverage. And that is sweetness, acidity, alcohol, and having the honey flavor be balanced, I think, is the most important thing to shoot for. And that is all proper fermentation and sanitation, which we'll get into later. So,
and Ken, do you have any tips to add about kind of defining what the mead styles are all about?
Well, the one comment I'll make is that the term dry has a broad variety of interpretations across the different sort of beverage alcohol sectors. And in beer, dry is pretty much associated with a lack of sugar, whereas in wine it can both be a lack of sugar and also considerable tannin content. So it's a combination of alcohol and acidity and astringency. So dry is one of those terms that, for the most part, in mead has been associated with things that are fermented completely, attenuated completely.
Right.
But there are other ways to interpret that as well. You've covered it. You've done a nice job covering it.
I would definitely encourage people.
I think the accurate thing you've really said is that. It is a Katie bar the door situation. Mm-hmm. This isn't especially in terms of judging and in terms of trying to make meads, you don't have as much opportunity to try and, for example, clone things. I've got a Bell's Two Hearted on the table in front of me, and that is a beer that you can go ahead and really try to nail in terms of profile, mm-hmm. whereas it's not as easy to do with meads, and it's almost not as much of a target to desire because there's so many opportunities out there for you to do different things. It's really an area in which long-standing commercial examples, for example, are limited almost to the few Polish meads that have been created and have remained unchanged for a few decades. Other than that, there aren't really things like classic pills styles or Doppelbox that have remained essentially a stable target for decades.
Right. It's a good point. I mean, there's really no definitive style yet. There's a range. Mm-hmm. There's no style.
Sure, okay. In Piment, for example, and I hate to pick on the commercial guys, but I'm a real wine lover as well as being a mead and beer lover, and as yet, I don't think anyone has crafted a Piment that really reaches the heights of expression of grapes and of typicity. That you can see in even very good commercial examples. For example, the Redstone Pinot Noir is a piment that has some definitively Pinot Noir characteristics, but it is not something that would be as enjoyably definitively Pinot Noir as even say a $15 or $20 bottle from Oregon. And so there's a lot of room right now for perfection and improvement in those styles. And that's the one great thing about mead is that there's so much right now that can be developed and pretty much even laid out as the new target by home mead makers. Amateurs have the opportunity now, really pretty much have in the United States, created a lot of the new standards, and then they get pushed into the commercial sector from the home mead makers.
All right, so we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, I want to get into the ingredients that make a great mead, and you know how simple it is to make great mead. Back after this.
Okay, so my double IPA has an ABV of 7.5 and a clarity of brilliant. So that's a plus 8. I pour it.
Sorry, looks like she found it unpalatable.
Ha!
Shut up, Doug.
My creek gets a plus 10 versus girls because it's a fruit beer.
You can't open the bottle, and she walks over to the guy with the Pinot Grigio.
This sucks!
Ugh, I hate it when Greg's the brewmaster.
What's this? Non-Alcoholics Anonymous?
Dude, get out of here. We're in the middle of a brew session.
Is that an actual beer?
Yeah. I crafted it. I don't really use the dice anymore. I'm a 10th level beer nerd.
Are you a 10th level beer nerd? Have you ever been called upon to explain why it's named India Pale Ale? Do you burp Y Yeast 3522 and crap Cascade? Then you're in good company at Northern Brewer. Northern Brewer has all your beer nerd needs, ingredients, equipment, and knowledge 24 hours a day at northernbrewer.com. Plus, fast, cheap shipping, only $7.99 for the contiguous USA. And check out Northern Brewer's huge selection of dorky beer kits, including the Tongue Splitter.
I've got dry hops stuck in my braces.
And the Bourbon Barrel Porter.
Now on tap in the Mos Eisley Cantina.
Make 10th level at northernbrewer.com.
Can, tasty. right, Cam. Tasty Pack. Cam, local neighborhood brew pub.
Hi.
Well,
I'm Sean O'Sullivan.
Tasty Crack Cam. Tasty Crack Cam. Tasty Crack Cam. Tasty Crack Cam. Brewmaster and co-founder of the 21st Amendment
Brewery and Restaurant in San Francisco.
That's right.
That's right.
Well, that day has come. Can.
You're listening to the Brewing Network.
And now, back to the Jameel Show.
All right, we're back. We're talking meads with famous author Ken Schramm of The Complete Mead Maker. I think the Bible of mead making. If you're interested at all in making mead, which you should be, because when it's done right, it's spectacular. You want to pick yourself up a copy of this book, and that's pretty much everything you need to know about mead making. It could make you mead maker of the year, like Kurt Stock.
Get one from the Northern Brewer.
Yeah, go to Northern Brewer, our sponsor. Northernbrewer.com. They have great prices, great selection, great customer service, cheap shipping, and they sell this excellent book, The Complete Mead Maker.
Who loves Ken Schramm? This guy right here. This guy running the Brewing Network right here loves Ken Schramm.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just want to point that out right now.
Lots of love.
Mentioning our sponsor. Because we that drink here before the show, you know, by the time the show's running, we can't remember anything.
Yeah.
So, Ken, tell us... I kind of get the impression from reading your book and, you know, just hanging out with other mead makers in general that ingredients play a huge role in the quality of the mead and making good mead. Is that true?
Sure. I'm going to kind of tie that in with the whole easy comment that you made earlier, actually. It can be extremely easy to make mead. If you're using a no-heat method and you're just going ahead and essentially mixing up the ingredients and pitching the yeast, then that can be quite simple. But the other half of that then is that you really need to spend a lot of time sourcing your ingredients. The quality of your finished mead can never be better than the quality of the ingredients that you begin with.
True that.
The thing that's markedly different between mead making and brewing is that the roadmap to great mead hasn't been laid out like it has for brewers. I'm going to go off a little bit on honey here, and the parallel in beer is malt.
Sure.
In brewing, yes. To get good malt, we really only have to call the Northern Brewer or any of your local homebrew shops, and they will pretty much guide you to tremendous varieties of malted barley. And the same, unfortunately, cannot be said for honey. Some of the homebrew shops have got good selections of honey, but there's an inclination on people's part to just go ahead and head down to Sam's Club and grab the honey off the shelf there, and boy, that'll be great.
Yeah.
And that attitude can get you in a lot of trouble.
Sure.
You brewers would never take that same approach. There are, you know, something, what is it? What, about a quarter of the barley that's grown in the United States ends up as malted barley. So three quarters of the stuff really isn't set up to be used in beer, and brewers would never take that same cavalier approach. They wouldn't go out and buy, you know, what essentially amounts to feed barley and expect to make extraordinary quality beer with it.
Sure, right.
But that peril faces mead makers if they think, well, you know, I'll just go and get the whatever honey. And what you end up with is mead that really doesn't stand the test of the table if it's in competition. So what you really need to do to begin with is to educate yourself a little bit about honey. Unlike brewing, the education's sort of got to happen on your palate.
Right.
And there are good ways. Going out to Honey Locator, for example, which is the National Honey Board's honey supplier sourcing directory on the web, honeylocator.com. And you can go out there. And what I would recommend for people is to acquire small quantities of honey and then start to assess those honeys based on the qualities that they want to have end up in their finished mead. And can do that by taste.
Okay.
And a real critical factor is most of it will be told in the aroma. Huh. If the character of the aroma is not something that you really think you're going to love, then don't bother with it.
A company like honeylocator.com, do they source out like regions of quality apiaries that actually grow these honeys?
Honey Locator is a non-profit service provided by the National Honey Board. And the National Honey Board really essentially supports beekeepers and honey producers across the country. What Honey Locator allows you to do is to go out and say, I'd like to get myself some basswood honey, and then select from a pull-down menu on their site basswood, and then they will tell you where you can locate that honey either in your area or where you can buy it in various quantities. There are some honeys that we know pretty much uniformly produce good to very good meads. Orange blossom, raspberry blossom, tupelo, and these are honeys that you'll see just creeping up and recurring regularly in the winner's circle of every
top three
NHC.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
But beyond that, to expand out into the different honeys that you can really work with and that do create good mead, you've got to do some experimentation, but you've also got to familiarize yourself with the honey to know if that's something that you're going to enjoy. Buckwheat, for example, is a honey that can make meads that some people enjoy immensely and other people don't like at all.
Right.
And best to find out by buying a pound of it if that's a flavor that you enjoy and an aroma that you enjoy, instead of buying 18 pounds of it and making a mead that you then are displeased with.
Okay.
So just going out and finding the honeys that really suit your fancy.
Okay.
And one of the things that I did when I got started was to dilute them. It's not a fermented pitcher that you're going to get, but when you dilute it down, say 3 to 1, mm-hmm. 3 parts water to 1 part honey, that'll give you a handle on what at least the starting must is. And you can, as brewers, we're all pretty familiar with tasting our wort before it's fermented to get a handle on what we're, if we're headed in the right direction. And that's a technique that I've done many times. And like I said, it's best to find out at the cost of 1 pound that's not such a good idea.
Well, Ken, you found, let's say I'm a mead maker, first time mead maker. I found this honey I like. I'm happy with the aroma. I diluted it down, like you said, 3 to 1. I'm happy with the taste. But one question I deal with a lot of customers and other mead makers is, how do you dilute it? What's the temperature range? I mean, is it 100 to 110? Is it above 150? Are you pasteurizing it?
I'm a no-heat guy at this point.
Are you really? Why is that?
That's probably the one... I can't claim any personal authorship for the nutrient thing. That research was all done by Morrison Steinkraus. But the one thing that I think I will sort of lay claim to is that I was the first person that I knew that said, I'm just going to make some without heating it, without using sulfites, without doing anything. And it worked fine.
Wow.
And I haven't made a sulfited or heated mead now in 10 years.
Wow.
And the thing that I do, when I go to start the dilution of the honey, I frequently will sanitize two plastic fermenters, or a plastic fermenter and a glass fermenter, and in the plastic, in a plastic fermenter, I will measure out the amount of honey that I want to use in my finished batch, and I will add a small amount of water to it, and I'll beat on it with an electric mixer until it becomes fully dissolved. And even if the honey is crystallized, you will eventually, and it'll only take 4 or 5 minutes. I want to, you know, compared to beer brewing processes, like I said, even the most arduous of these tasks is brief by comparison. So you just beat on it with a KitchenAid or, you know, whatever you've got, kitchen blender, sanitize your beaters and crank away on it, and you can be completely done with that process in 5, 6, maybe 10 minutes at most. And now you've got a really aerated start to what you're going to end up completely diluting up to your total volume.
Well, that's interesting too that you bring up is there a lack of nutrients that does not exist in honey, I should say? Is that, like, as a mead maker, should you add nutrients to it to actually have a proper ferment?
Yeah, mead musts are nutrient deserts. I did a little measuring, or I didn't do it, but I sent it to the New York Ag Experiment Station and had their wine lab do some analysis of some musts that I put together. And none of them got over 25 parts per million of available nitrogen.
Wow.
So, you, and to try and ferment something that's going to end up at 12.5%, 13% alcohol, you should really be starting at 300, 325, 350 parts per million of available nitrogen.
Okay.
So, yeah, you're in a nutrient, a massively nutrient deficient condition. And as well, the same is true with the other various micronutrients that are needed for really healthy fermentations, most notably biotin. Potassium is one that can be determinative of really good yeast health, and it's not a lock that you'll be potassium deficient, because some honeys have very high potassium levels in them, buckwheat, for example. And the darker the honey, the greater the chance you will be closer to the potassium level that you're looking for. But if your honey would be, you know, to your own mind's eye, would be lighter in color than, say, a pale ale, the chances are you're going to be low in potassium, you're going to be low in manganese, magnesium, just a whole panoply of, well, essentially all the same vitamins that all the living creatures need to go through, all of the various Krebs cycles and EMP cycles that they use to metabolize their food sources. And the same thing is true with, especially true with yeast during its reproductive phase. It needs to grow. It needs a lot of nitrogen, and it generally needs it in those free amino nitrogen forms to be able to synthesize the cell walls that it needs to reproduce.
Right.
So it's critically important to have to reach the high levels of nutrient and especially nitrogen that you need to get that yeast off to a good start.
Well, the nutrient the nutrient you're talking about is like Ferment K or DAP, right?
Right, right. Okay. DAP provides the nitrogen, and Ferment K provides the micronutrients.
Okay,
and that's the lack of nitrogen is probably the single greatest cause of that. Kind of a dry cleaner fluid like mead that we all had so many bottles of, well, I don't know how, back in the 80s and 90s when there wasn't as much understanding of yeast nutrition and really healthy fermentation.
Okay. Well, I mean, obviously nitrogen is important, so is oxygen for yeast cell growth and health and,
yep,
you know, proper fermentation.
Yep.
What about choosing an appropriate yeast based on the honey that you chose? I mean,
that is a great question, and that's an area where where mead is at a disadvantage with respect to the other beverages. There has never been as much money thrown at the research that would be required to do sort of massive matrix experimentation to get to that kind of knowledge. Uh-huh. It would be tremendously valuable if somebody would take 20 different really high quality honeys and then ferment them in a grid against 25 or 30 really high quality yeasts. That level of experimentation is the kind of thing that happens in the wine world and in the beer world, because they have the resources at hand to do those kinds of experiments. But nobody in the yeast, nobody in the mead world has had the money to do those kinds of yeast experiments yet.
Does your book cover that at all, like that type of stuff that you're talking about?
It does cover, and in fact, Dan and I did an experiment. It was one of the things that sort of got us off the ground and brought us to the attention of Charlie and various other people, Byron Birch and whatnot. We did a cross pollination of six different meads with the same yeast, and then six different yeasts with the same honey.
That probably blew your hair back a little bit, huh?
Six different honeys with the same yeast, six different yeasts with the same honey. There we go.
Okay.
It allowed us to see the difference between the various honeys when they were fermented out,
sure.
And then to see the expression of the different yeasts on the same honey.
Right.
And then we presented that all at the 94. NHC was in Denver.
Okay.
That was a spectacular day. We took 13 kegs of mead.
Whoa.
Out and
were you hungover?
We weren't, because we were talking, but everyone that was drinking while we were talking.
Oh, yeah. That's a lot of wow.
Yeah, they moved in a different fashion after our presentation. Hmm. There's a tremendous need for that. The more of that can go on, and the better it can be documented and, as I said, presented in front of large groups of people who can then do the analysis themselves and figure out what they like,
right.
The better it will be.
Well, and speaking of what we like, so I've had the pleasure of tasting Byron Birch's meads several times in competition. I didn't know at the time. But later on found out that mead I thought was just so incredibly well-balanced and so drinkable and such delicate character expressed in so many different ways was always Byron's meads. And he may not have always won, but he, you know, what's that guy doing? You know, what mental focus does he have that allows him to develop these things that are really just out of this world?
Well, Byron goes the extra mile to acquire really good ingredients. He understands, and his meads are great. I have to agree with you. Every time I've encountered a Byron Birch mead in a competition, or when he's poured one for me on the floor of the NHC or the conference, it's been a really spectacular experience. And Byron's got that wonderful balance between being a technician and being a culinary artist. He understands the selection of really good ingredients, and then he's got a knack for figuring out, one of the best meads of his I've ever had was a raspberry mead, and he's got a knack for figuring out which honey variety is going to come across and balance itself with this fruit, and how much of the two ingredients do I have to play against each other so that they're complementary as opposed to being at war with each other?
Well, and is he also is he also balancing with, like, you know, acid blend or tannin or, you know, any of that stuff? Is he dialing a little bit of tinkering
after his fermentations? But I my impression of what I've experienced through Byron is that a lot of that comes from experience. And the same thing will be true of lots of folks in the amateur world as they get familiar with their sets of ingredients and their process. They'll learn how much the acidity in raspberries and how much acidity from how many raspberries will counterbalance how much sweetness from their honey. That's one of Kurt's real strengths, is understanding, for example, that if you're going to use just a ton of black currants, that it's going to require a tremendous amount of honey and sweetness to back that up and provide the balance. And that is it, like I said, it's part measurement, but it's also part intuition and experience. Mm. And it's something that actually I think goes into a lot of winemaking.
Absolutely,
it's a part of the craft that bears more resemblance to winemaking than it does to the sort of the technical aspect of brewing. Mm-hmm.
But it's more manly than winemaking, I think.
Maybe.
So, well, let's take a short break. And when we get back, Ken, I'd like you to give us a basic recipe that the listeners can start with and, have success at making a great mead. Back after this.
Okay, I rolled a 15 and I get a +2 from my yeast starter.
Nope, sorry, you failed your roll. Your beer is infected.
No way!
You had to beat a 24. It's schizosaccharomyces.
This sucks! I just failed versus oxidation! Our party is fracked! Doug's the only one left and his beer is a Berliner Weiss!
What's this? A tea party?
Hey, this is a brew session, man. Get lost!
Is that an actual beer?
Yeah, I crafted it. I don't really use the dice anymore. I'm a 10th level beer nerd.
Are you a 10th level beer nerd? Does your significant other know the difference between an Irish red ale and a Flanders red ale? Do you burp, drizzle, spalt, and fart Y-Yeast 2308? Then you're in good company at Northern Brewer. Northern Brewer has all your beer nerd needs, ingredients, equipment, and knowledge 24 hours a day at northernbrewer.com. Plus, fast, cheap shipping, only $7.99 for the contiguous USA. And check out Northern Brewer's huge selection of dorky beer kits, including the socially awkward Patter's Beer and the sci-fi convention showstopper number 8. Make 10th level at northernbrewer.com.
What have you gotten out of a vial of White Labs yeast?
WLP 001 Cal Ale, baby.
23 Burton Ale.
008 East Coast Ale.
Cal Common. WLP 810.
It's gonna be WLP 400 with beer.
I got a sweet hoodie for my vial.
Huh?
White Labs, your source for great brewer's yeast, would like to invite all homebrewers to join the White Labs Customer Club. Redeem your empty vials for great White Labs merchandise and products. Free yeast, glassware, t-shirts, baseball caps, sweatshirts, polo shirts, and you won't believe what you'll get for 5,000 vials. Members also receive a newsletter packed with White Labs updates and facts, interviews with professional brewers, brew your own clone recipes, beercook.com recipes, and customer club stories. The White Labs Customer Club. Save your vials and get in the club. White Labs. It's all in the vial.
Live. Beer Radio. The Brewing Network.
The Brewcasters.
If you're just starting, don't be discouraged by all this stuff. It's exactly. So easy.
Just throw it together.
Put some sugar and some water and some yeast in there.
Yeah.
Network. Williams Brewing is your online resource for prompt delivery of quality home brewing supplies. Since 1979, Williams Brewing has offered the finest equipment and freshest ingredients and the best customer service in the business. Cut hours off your brewing sessions by using one of their 11 varieties of famous Williams malt extract. Their Williams German Pils is mashed with pure German Moravian two-row barley malt for a light blonde color and malty Christmas you just can't get from other extracts. Or check out their unique fermenters, draft beer equipment, bottling aids, and more. They even have their own line of precision hydrometers. Go to williamsbrewing.com to browse their vast selection and enter promo code BREW at the order checkout for $5 off your next order over $50. Orders placed by 3 p.m. ship the same day. Again, go to williamsbrewing.com and enter promo code BREW at checkout for $5 off your next order. Brewing is easy the Williams way.
This is The Jameel Show.
Woo! Da-na-na. Da-na-na. So freaking lively in the studio during the breaks.
Da-na-na.
Beer refreshing, nipple grabbing, all that stuff.
Fly swatting.
Fly swatting. Fly zipping, yes.
Oh, sorry.
That's coming back. Back break. Okay.
Right.
We're here with Ken Schramm talking meads, and Ken is one of the most knowledgeable guys about mead, wrote the Bible, complete mead maker. And Ken, you're going to give us a kind of a recipe and a step-by-step. So somebody can go from never making a mead in their lives to making something that's actually quite a good mead, right?
Sure, sure. Let's walk it through. We're going to start with the sanitized plastic fermenter, 7.5 gallon, like you would use for a 5 gallon batch of beer. And into the bottom of that, we're going to put, let's put 20 pounds of orange blossom honey. We're going to do an orange blossom vanilla mead here. And this will be something that will be, on the sweeter side, this will go over extremely well with your wife.
That's important.
I'm sorry?
That's very important.
Very important.
Happy wife, happy life, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
So we're going to take the 20 pounds, we're going to add a little less than a gallon of water, and with our sanitized kitchen mixer, we're going to just beat the snot out of it until that's come to a uniform mixture. It's going to take about 5 minutes, and once we've got that done, then let's go ahead and make a starter. And we're going to use dry yeast. We're going to use Lallemand's 71B-1122, Lalvan, which is their home brewing, home mead-making brand. We're going to use 15 grams of it, and we're going to use about 20 grams of their Go Firm yeast hydrating additive. And what that's going to do is provide some stability and some nutrient for those rehydrating yeast cells to use to stabilize their walls. Because rehydration of yeast, of a dry yeast, is a very delicate process. It's taking the yeast from its most vulnerable state, which is having been freeze-dried. It's just a really stressful act. And those cell walls get put into their most potentially fragile state. We're going to use the exact recipe that they call for, 50 milliliters of water per pack, and we're going to rehydrate that with a... First, we're going to mix the 20 grams of Go Firm in with the water, and then we're going to just pour those yeast packets onto the surface of that water. One of the things that I do, kind of a trick that I do, is to use a cake pan to do my rehydration in, because when you rehydrate the yeast, you're going to pour the dry yeast onto the surface of the liquid, and the larger the surface of the liquid is, the more evenly the yeast can begin to absorb that water. And we're not going to stir it at all while that's in process. It's going to be about a 20-minute process to rehydrate that yeast, and we're not going to touch it at all. That water is going to be at 104 degrees Fahrenheit when we add the Go Firm, stir that in, and then just sprinkle that yeast across the surface of that water, and it will begin to absorb it, and it'll start to get a little foamy, not like the bread starters, but you'll see it begin to become active again. And it's best to let that stuff just absorb water as it will. In the meantime, then we'll go back and we will add the remaining amount of water that we're going to use to get up to our 5 gallon volume. Once we've got that done, sometimes I like to take in my sanitizing solution, I'll get the airlock that I'm going to use. I frequently also sanitize a ladle, and I'll ladle out a little bit and take a gravity reading. With 20 pounds, you're probably going to be somewhere in between 1140 and 1150 for your starting gravity, depending on the moisture content of the honey that you started with. What I've been doing of late to add that water back up without adding any chlorine or chloramine is to use bottled spring water. And that's an important thing for you to use, to not use a distilled water, because if you use water that has been completely stripped of all of its micronutrients, that's going to put your yeast at a disadvantage. It needs the manganese and the copper and all those little bits of minerals that it will draw from the water.
Calcium can't flocculate without calcium.
Exactly. So you don't want to use distilled water. You want to use a really high quality. And I do the same approach with my water that I do with my honey. I sniff around until I find one that I like, and sniff and taste, and then just go out and buy 5 gallons of it in individual gallons or larger containers, and use that for your mead making water. You take your gravity reading, whip away again on it once you've added the water, and you're up to your full brewing volume. Whip away on it again with the mixers to add a little more oxygen, and when the yeast is completely hydrated, then you can gently stir that just a small little bit and pitch it right into the bucket. Put the lid on and put the airlock on, and don't even feel obliged to stir that up. If you can leave those yeasts, those new yeasts undisturbed, they'll reproduce well and they'll appreciate your gentleness with them as they begin their new task.
What I find interesting, Ken, is the amount of focus you put on preparing the yeast, and the lesser amount you put on preparing the must, the honey water mixture, right? And
sure.
And what I found is, there's 20 billion cells of yeast per gram of dry yeast on average. 20
right.
billion. If you look at what the manufacturer says, it's like 6 billion to 8 billion, right? And I'm thinking, all right, so people question me all the time. It's like, well, how can you say there's 20 billion when the manufacturer says there's 6 to 8? So while there's 6 to 8 billion viable cells, if you just sprinkle it on top of your wort or your must, but if you properly rehydrate it, like Ken's saying, you'll get yeast that's well prepared to ferment out something that's 20 pounds of honey. You'll get something that's, you know, ready to go. If you just sprinkle it on there like the manufacturer says for the homebrew site, if you go to the professional site, they tell you to rehydrate. If you go to the homebrew site, they tell you to sprinkle it on. If you just sprinkle it on, you're putting half of that yeast is going to be dead yeast that drops to the bottom of the fermenter and eventually breaks down. And
absolutely.
That's not going to be good for the overall flavor and fermentation that you're trying to achieve. So what Ken's focusing on, I think, is one of the critical things for great mead is making sure you properly rehydrate, you give your yeast a great start in life, and you've got everything set for them to fully reproduce and properly ferment what is a huge load of sugar.
Yeah, he's doing 3 grams per gallon.
Yeah, that's a lot.
Yeah. If you are really going to be anal retentive about the acclimation of that yeast starter to your mead, what you can do is take that ladle then and ladle in, and if you're willing to take the additional time, you can ladle in another 50 to 100 milliliters of your must into your starter, and that. You can do that over the course of a half an hour. You can keep continually adding another ladle every 10 minutes or so, and that will give the yeast, again, a slow acclimation to their new sugar environment, because they're going from water and some additional nitrogen and free amino nitrogen they can use to build up that cell wall mass to if you just took it and dumped it in, it would be going from a no nutrient environment to one with, like you said, just a spectacular amount of sugar. So you can slowly add some of that must into your starter and then pitch. The delay is not something that's going to at all negatively impact your yeast. And in fact, the yeast rehydration at 104. Will be optimal. It will absorb the water best at 104 degrees, but then you're going to turn around and pitch that culture into a must solution that's probably at 70, roughly 75 degrees. If everything you started with everything at room temperature, so that again is another shock, like you said, that can immediately reduce your viable yeast cell population by up to 40% if you just take it and pour it in there. 30 to 40% of those cells are going to die right then.
Well, and even with these extra steps, you're still talking a fraction of the amount of effort it takes to brew a batch of beer.
Absolutely. I mean, at this point, if we've really done everything right, we're a half an hour into the process. maybe 45 minutes if we've been very slow about our sanitation.
All right. So you got your must and you've added the yeast. And what's our next steps?
Well, now we're going to let it go through a lag phase. It's going to go through about 6 to 8 hours while some of that yeast begins to reproduce. It's going to be reproducing in an environment that doesn't have much nitrogen in it, but that's okay for the first 6 hours. But then it's going to need more. So if we did this in an evening or if we did this at the start of the day, about 6 to 8 hours later, we're going to need to supplement the amount of nutrient that it needs. And just to keep it simple and straightforward, let's add 1/2 teaspoon of diammonium phosphate and 1/4 teaspoon of Firmaid K. And we're going to do that then every 24 hours for the next 3 days. So each time we're gonna pull the lid off, we're gonna aerate well, and then which will serve to both add oxygen into the must while it's in the reproductive phase, and also to degas some of the CO2 that's in there, and we will add additional nitrogen and micronutrients. So 1/2 teaspoon of ammonium phosphate and another 1/4 teaspoon of Firmaid K.
So aerate by stirring with a sanitized spoon and just dump the diammonium phosphate and the Firmaid K straight in, no mixing or diluting or anything like that.
I don't see any real purpose to stir it up. As long as it's not chunky or anything like that. If you add it, it will get mixed into the solution.
And how aggressively do we stir it? Till it's foamy or just more gently?
Well, the first time you stir it, there's not going to be a lot of CO2 in there to degas. But on the second, third, and if we're going to do a traditional like this, I'm going to make 4 additions like this. So that's going to actually be over the course of really 72 hours, but 4 separate additions. Once you get to the second and the third time, it's going to foam up. It's going to foam up pretty well. And that's fine. That's perfectly normal. You want that to happen. You want that carbon dioxide in the must will suppress that yeast's activity, both its reproductive activity and its fermentation. So it's good to get that out of the must and stir it up. I stir it aggressively, and I do exactly like you said. I generally keep an iota-4 solution with my slotted stainless steel spoon in it, and if I'm feeling real particular, I rinse it off with some extremely hot tap water, and then just stir it.
And my
diammonium phosphate.
And that probably adds a bit more of an estery profile to things, too, as well. The more CO2 you have, the more it suppresses the yeast activity, and the activity occurs and actually holds down on ester production. But you release that CO2, and in something like a mead, you're looking for some of that fruity character and that yeast and honey character to it, more like a wine-like than you are like a clean beer. You want that, right?
Exactly. And if you leave, I tend not to, but leaving that CO2 in there will cause it to be a more reductive beverage, and as it when it's young, then it will need more oxygen to express those characters that you're talking about. It'll require decanting and long periods of time in the glass before it really begins to show what its real bouquet and aromatic profile are like. So I like to get that CO2 out of there so that It will be a year or two before it really hits its stride, but it's not gonna have a period of initial just really closedness. I guess that would be that's kind of the beer or probably the wine approach to that. So yeah, we're gonna do that. We're gonna do that four times, and then after the fourth time, we're gonna go ahead and put the fermentation lock on it, and it should complete its fermentation in between 14 and 21 days, which is contrary to what was the sort of the de rigueur expectation
6 months
of
a year
long ago when people thought meads took months to ferment.
Yeah.
A year.
Oh yeah, that's what I was always told.
Yeah, they should be done in a good fermentation like that should be done in about 21 days. 28 is not unacceptable.
Well, and for something at that high a starting gravity, if you were doing a big barley wine, you'd expect something that long too. So it should be kind of tracking the same thing as an ale yeast almost, or brewing your average ale if you're up at that gravity. Absolutely.
Yep. So once it's completed its fermentation, now and you see that airlock has really pretty much gone flat, then we'll go ahead and rack and proceed with the same sort of procedures we would use for beer. Although I like to make sure that I've gotten myself into a vessel, an appropriately sized vessel that doesn't leave a lot of headspace there, because oxidation, especially if you're going to be aging for months at a time, becomes an issue. Like to see to it that I end up with a 5 gallon carboy completely full to the neck, and then I'll just let it age.
How long are you aging it for usually?
A mead like this will be drinkable at 4 or 5 months.
Okay.
So that if you let it age until it's clear, you're fine.
And then drink.
Yep. But now I said we were going to do something with vanilla. We've got it into the secondary, and we've got only a small amount of air space in there. After it's aged out, and it's now we've seen absolutely no airlock activity for a couple of weeks, to get the vanilla character in there and have it have a fresh and vibrant vanilla taste to it, we'll take I take a muslin tea bag and a 6-inch vanilla bean, and we can cut that into roughly 1-inch sections. Split it and cut it all into 1-inch sections. And if you're particular about sanitation, you can steam that for 5 minutes or so. But I'm not as concerned. Once we've really hit that 14% alcohol that we should roughly be at right now, I'm pretty confident that the mead can withstand a tiny bit of microbial infection load that's going to come from a vanilla bean.
What gravity is that? So you started at 1040 to 1050, and where should
we
be now?
We're going to be down to about, we started at 1140 to 1150, and we're going to be down now to about 1145, roughly.
Okay.
So we've got 14% alcohol in this thing, 13.5%, 14%. That's what 71B1122 will give us. And then we'll take that and put it into that muslin bag. And the approach I would take is I would steam the muslin bag and then put the vanilla in it and cram that thing down into the neck of the carboy and stick this. It will have the muslin tea bags that you can buy online will generally have drawstrings on them, and pull the drawstrings up, put the vanilla down into the mead, and stick your bung back in the top of the carboy, and leave it in there for 4 to 5 days. Then go down there with a small section with a racking cane, for example, and wine thief off a little dribble of it, and do that once every couple of days until you hit the degree of vanilla flavor that you think is fine, and then pull it out again. And you're done with your vanilla flavoring. That's a very simple and straightforward way to get spice character into a mead.
So a metheglin.
Yep.
Okay. So if you didn't add the vanilla, you've got a traditional mead, probably a sweet sack mead, right?
That's correct.
And then you could carbonate it and have various levels of carbonation. Or you go ahead and do the vanilla or pepper or God knows what.
Cinnamon.
Yep. And then you've got a methaglen. All right.
Yep.
So is there an easy way to make a piment or a braggot or a melomel? How do we go about doing those? Don't worry, you got like 3 minutes.
The easiest way to make melomel is grow some trees, and then but let's talk about a braggot.
Okay, and take us down the road of somebody who's starting out. So you've gotten us through our first steps, and mm-hmm. what you would recommend next? You're teaching us. We don't need to drive it any way other than that.
Sure. If I was going to go next for a braggot, one of the braggots that I'm really fond of is one that's got a lot of honey character to it, but also that has something of that Thomas Hardy's ale approach to deep aggressive maltiness and some bitterness. So, without going into a whole lot of depth on how to do this, let's start with a couple of cans of malt extract, or a couple of 3-pound bags of dry malt extract, and let's boil that up in about 4 gallons of water. And to that, we're going to add 10 pounds of blackberry honey. Blackberry honey is a great honey to make braggots with because it in and of itself has a high maltose character to it, and as well, it has a really profoundly strong honey character, which is important when you're doing braggots because if you're going to ferment to approximately dry character, you will end up with... You can end up with, as anyone who's tried to make a honey beer and use a light honey will attest, it can just get all eaten up, and there's almost no honey character left. So you want something with a really assertive profile, a very assertive honey profile, and blackberry honey is a really good honey to do that with. About 10 pounds of that, if you just go through a traditional extract approach to making a beer, you can even do a smaller boil. And then at the end of the boil, add the 10 pounds of honey and do whatever wort chilling procedure you would have to get yourself up to your five. Hold on. I'm leaving out the hops. Whoops.
It's okay.
No, let's put a bunch of hops in.
Yeah, throw it in.
Let's put about 65 IBUs.
Woo.
Yep. And let's start with 50 IBUs. Of a really robust, like a Chinook or an Eroica, that's gonna just provide profound bitterness, and then finish with something that's gonna have the appropriate hop character that you like. If you like a more New World approach, maybe you want to go with Cascades or Centennial, or if you like a more English style, let's go with an East Kent Goldings, right? And we'll finish with. So we'll go with 50 IBUs at the start for 60 minutes. We'll go with 10 IBUs for 20 minutes, and then we'll go with that final 5 IBUs either as a final 5 minutes or as a post boil addition for quasi dry hopping. And then as we're dry hopping, we can add that honey, because what we're going to try and do is keep as much of its aromatic character as possible, so we don't want to boil that off.
So this is definitely in the secondary, then. Is this off the primary?
No. No, this is in the boil kettle.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
To dissolve it in.
Okay.
We'll add that 10 pounds of blackberry honey. Stir it in, and then we can, if we're doing just a straight old fashioned extract approach, we can. Pour that into our fermenter, add water up, add spring water up to our 5-gallon brew length, and use whatever wort chilling procedure you're in. Myself, I would use a plastic fermenter with an immersion chiller and chill that down to 70 and proceed with the same approach with the yeast culturing. I when I'm doing braggots, I have them, you know, I'm going to tend to use something that's more of a beer yeast, an English ale or a stout, something that I know will capture the appropriate, you know, that will match the yeast character with the hopping approach that I've taken. If I'm going to use, let's just say we're going to go with the East Kent Goldings and an Irish ale yeast, and pitch that in, and then you're going to go through the same process you would for any extract, fermentation, and let it run its course and get it into a secondary, and then carbonate it, and whether you're going to serve it off keg or bottles.
So Ken, I'm really lazy, as anyone will tell you. Anyone that
yeah you are.
And one of the things I've done to make a braggot is I'll have like a stock ale, and then I've got my traditional mead, and I pour whatever percentage of one and the other, tastes about right, and bottle it up. I'm done. I've got Cabernet Sauvignon. I've got my traditional mead. I pour the two together in whatever percentage. I've got piment.
That's how you do it.
Yeah,
do it.
Yeah.
Guilty.
The one thing I don't like.
Do it,
I mean, the thing I think that's really come up short in the piment category is I don't think water was a traditional ingredient in piments. I think what they were doing, if you look back at how piment sort of got its start in the Russian, or pardon me, in Roman times and among the Greeks, they were using honey to chaptalize low gravity grapes, or they were using honey.
Yeah,
they were adding honey. They were adding honey to already fermented wines to increase their sweetness and take away from the sort of high acidities or other issues that they were having with those wines that were making them unattractive to drink.
I think that makes 100% sense.
Absolutely.
I think that's absolutely correct.
Sure. So what we're doing when we're making a sort of watered down version of a piment with water, honey, and maybe a can of Alexander's extract is not, I don't think, in the same vein as the beverages were originally. And I really hope to see more. I mean, the best piment I've ever had was one that McConnell did, and that was done with pure Riesling, and that was mm-hmm. chaptalized up to a higher gravity, and then made something that was from Michigan Riesling, which never really reaches high degrees of sugar and ripeness. Instead, it has high degrees of acidity and a low sugar content, and then he added honey to it, and it created something that was more like a Trockenbeer and Auslese in its mouthfeel and its delivery, but also had vibrant levels of acidity and vibrant levels of just really impactful fruit character. That's the kind of piment I think is compelling to my tastes.
So you're running into pumpkin time where you need to go to bed so you can get up at like the crack of freaking still before dawn and get to work. So I a couple of things I want to cover. I want to cover the listener questions which are coming up from the chat room, and I want you to touch on blending and tweaking with like acids and tannins and things like that. Okay, so go for it. You got a few minutes, and then we got to get to the chat room.
Well, yeah, let's leave acid until the end of the fermentation.
Okay.
If you're someone that wants to add acidity and really likes brisk acidity in their meads, don't add them at the front, because lowering the pH during the fermentation can cause stuck fermentation. So let's let the fermentation occur healthily, and then go ahead and do that prior to kegging or bottling, and do it to taste. Use small amounts of acid blend, and add it in a gram at a time or a quarter teaspoon at a time, whatever your small increment is, to your total batch. And you can do the same approach: sanitize a stainless steel ladle and add small amounts into that, to the ladle, dissolve it completely, then dissolve it back into the total amount, and taste it until it hits where you want to be, and use that as your guidepost. It's a lot easier to get it right that way, and to not overshoot or undershoot, and it's also not going to compromise your yeast or your yeast health during your fermentation by crashing your pH. And the same thing, I take that same approach with, and I've done what you're talking about, blending with beers, and I've done the same thing blending meats together. The one thing I will say about blending meats together is it can work out really well if you have a certain mead that's lacking something or a certain mead that has too much of something, but I would never ask, this is the same cue-in, cue-out approach. Don't ever expect that if you've got a really bad mead, you can somehow save it by blending, unless the only thing that's bad about it is it's too acidic, and you can blend it with a mead that lacks acidity. But if it's got something that's really nasty, for example, higher alcohols, there's nothing you can do.
Just you blend and crap, and you just ruin another mead trying to blend it out. Just throw it out and start over, or make, you know, precisely. or just. You know, choke it down or give it to your wino friends.
I don't know.
Or send it to the alcohol recovery program.
use it to make marinades out of.
All right.
I'm going to
make some mead.
I think we could go for another hour and a half. I think we could go for another 10.5 hours, and you've got so much great information, and I guarantee anyone that's listening, buy a copy of Ken's book, The Complete Mead Maker. It's available everywhere, and I imagine it's available on the Brewing Network store. Go to the www.thebrewingnetwork.com, and you can get yourself a copy of The Complete Mead Maker there in the store, and it helps support programming like this. And I swear to God, you know, follow Ken's instructions in that book. If you don't make a great mead,
blame it on Jamil.
Call me up; I'll refund your money.
There you go.
I'm serious. It's really well written, and it's got all this information in it. I think we gained a few gems that aren't quite in the book, or hearing it just spoken, it helped me actually. I think it made the process that much simpler for me.
Yeah,
I mean, it's really very easy, and I think you're going to make a great mead.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody who's interested, try it at least once. It's well worth buying the book and buying a 20 pounds of honey and giving it a go.
Right.
I think you'd be very surprised at how easy it is and the quality of the results if you follow Ken's instructions.
Right.
If you follow to a T, it's going to turn out really good.
Absolutely.
Justin, we have a question from the chat room.
Lots of questions from the chat room. A couple things to point out. I'm really glad it's the second to last Jamil show, because I think Jamil's a dickhead. I just want to say that to everybody right now.
I waited 3 years to say that, didn't you?
Yeah. You know, thank you. You couldn't have waited for the last show.
No.
You had to, like, you know, ruin the last show for me now.
I have to be nice to you on the last show, so I figure on the second to last show, I'm allowed to say good riddance. And then on the last show, I go, oh, no, it was really great.
The most listened to show on the Brewing Network.
There goes Bruce.
And he's giving me crap.
And I say good riddance. And by the way, the chat room also noticed that you phoned in half of this episode, Jamil. You put your feet up. You had your arms behind you. You're relaxing. You're chilling. They were saying
they
asked, hey, where the hell's Jamil?
Yeah, I've got one of the greatest experts on the line. I'm supposed to yakety yak and ruin what Ken's saying?
I think they're used to me hosting shows, and that's what I do.
Right.
Talk over the great people.
It's time for me to shut up. John was doing a brilliant job too.
Okay.
And John and Ken talking through making great mead.
Okay.
What am I supposed to do?
I guess
shut up.
Right.
That's what I'm supposed to do.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then my last is that today's quote of the day came from our wonderful guest Ken Schramm, and it was a sniff and taste. That's it. It was very simple.
I like that.
Scratch and sniff and taste.
Sniff and taste. I think it goes for mead and it goes for life.
Actually, I got two more for you. I got sanitized your beaters.
You got that, okay.
Yeah, yeah. And I got your massive matrix.
Okay.
That's what he...
I think that...
grab those beaters, sanitize them.
I think if Love Strong get ever away. Comes to fruition and it has different episodes, one of them could be called Sniff and Taste.
Sounds perfect.
That's why I liked it. Yeah. All right, Ken, here's how it works. We got a lot of questions, a lot of live listeners in here today, and a lot of questions for you. So maybe we can try to just do a little bit of rapid fire and get through them all.
Sure.
Okay. All right. First of all, as you were talking about a lot of, I think, mixing up with a spoon when you're talking about stirring up the yeast and all that. What about using CO2 instead? They just want to know, do we have to spoon it? Can you use something else in there, or does it need to be an instrument like that?
During the fermentation process, I'm aiming to get some oxygen into the mead. And that's what I'm doing with the slotted spoon. And I'm also kind of got in the habit of it because frequently I'm making melomels, and I want to try and punch down the cap as well. So that's my approach. If you're used to using bottled oxygen, that will work fine.
So you can use oxygen to stir it up, and yep, not sure. CO2.
That'd probably be better because you'd want to get rid of the CO2.
Okay,
yeah.
Got it.
Yeah, in traditionals, as long as you're for degassing, I like a spoon.
Well, and what about just pumping, taking the aquarium pump with a sterile filter and pumping mm-hmm. air through?
That works as well.
That's with a sintered stone and stir it up that way, and also adding oxygen.
Okay.
Yeah, I think the actual agitation though does help to drive the
CO2
off.
Right, right.
Okay. Here's another good question. What about using wine yeast for mead?
Oh, I use that on a regular basis.
That's did use Lalden, the
71B1122 is a wine yeast.
Okay.
I also use D47. I've used Ostenshausen. I've used a couple of the different Riesling yeasts. I've used Lafort. They're one of their really nice Sauternes yeasts. So, yeah. I do that, and not to pump it too much, but there's a decent section of the book that talks about the different wine yeasts. One of the big advantages of using wine yeast as opposed to beer yeast is that wine musts are traditionally of a lower pH, as will your mead must be. So if you're looking for something that works really well at a pH down around 4, as opposed to a pH of 4.5 to 5.5, which is where beer worts tend to be, you're better to deal with wine yeasts. And they're also used to being the workhorse, cranking through 12.5, 13% alcohol.
Okay.
Well, I'm not trying to push books here, but I'll tell you this, right? So honey is not cheap. Okay, be prepared to pay, you know, a few bucks for quality honey. You're going to pay, but it's worth it, right? And you're going to save yourself a ton of time doing a mead. But I'll tell you this: buy a copy of the book. You know, sit on the bowl as many hours as it takes and read the book cover to cover, and that is going to save you, quite a few bucks in wasted honey if you buy a copy of this book. It's not selling books, it's making sure you have good results. Now, what Ken's told you throughout the show, I think you could you actually would make a good mead, but you know, if you're going to make a couple of meads, you know, buy this book. It's cheap compared to the cost of, you know, it's a price of like, you know, less than one batch of mead.
Yeah.
So buy it, read it, and then, you know, definitely do some meads. And it's a cost savings. Mm. It's protection. It's guaranteed that your mead will turn out right.
All right.
So your quote is massive matrix, but my lasting image from this time together.
Yeah.
Big load?
Book on bowl. Book on bowl.
Book on bowl, exactly. And by the way, it takes an hour a day, Jamil,
yes.
if it's me. And then speaking of, Jamil, you mentioning how expensive honey is and not messing up. Somebody in the chat room mentioned that it's difficult to get heather honey. And I don't know if anyone has a comment on that, if that is something that's difficult to get or if that's a regional thing. They were asking
why. Is
that
like stripper honey?
It's difficult to get.
I like Monica's honey.
You prefer that over heather honey?
Yeah.
There are probably two holy grails of honey. They are Scottish heather and Provençal lavender honey.
Sounds good.
they make good meads that take a while to age to really hit their stride. But you're right, they're extremely expensive and very hard to come by.
But how about a really, relatively cheap and good honey, orange blossom?
Yeah, absolutely.
That was his top three.
Make a great mead, and especially on the West Coast, anywhere in California, orange blossom honey is pretty darn cheap, comparatively.
And the nice thing about that is you can be really confident that you're actually getting local orange blossom honey.
Yeah, yeah.
If you're in the Midwest, you may be getting stuff from Argentina and China and wherever, but that's a great way to support your local beekeeper, and please do that.
Okay. All right, some more questions on mead. Somebody asked about hopping a mead, Ken. Would you do that, or how would you do it?
Oak aging.
You know, that's something that...
That was in there.
Yeah. Oh.
No, I wouldn't. I mean, braggots, yeah, definitely I'm putting hops in braggots. But really the character that I'm looking to get out of a mead is the honey and or the other constituent ingredients, I really think a better show place for hops is in pale ales and the traditional places that we enjoy them. I think they're better. They're a better counterpoint with malt than they are with honey.
Okay. Here might be an involved question, so let's do our best. Somebody asked about a stepped nutrient approach, and if you have any thoughts about that.
Yeah, that's what I was talking about, adding nutrients, a half a teaspoon of DAP. There are a couple of different approaches. If you go out and take a look around, I've actually written an article that appeared a few years ago in Zymergy on optimizing honey fermentation that talks about even extending out that step to 10 steps. There's also a different approach that's advocated by, it kind of came out of a protocol developed by Clayton Cohn for adding nutrients at the end of the lag phase and then again at the one-third sugar break, which is, once you've worked through one-third of the sugar, then you do another nutrient addition. And both of them have at their core the fact that yeast will ferment faster while it is still in a reproductive phase, and will be much more aggressive and much healthier as the longer you can prolong that reproductive phase. There's kind of a sort of a misconception of how that happens among brewers that all of the yeast go from the reproductive phase to the anaerobic phase. It looks uniformly, and the fact of the matter is it's more of a gradient. A certain percentage of them move into the reproductive or out of the reproductive phase into the fermentative phase, and a certain percentage of them continue to reproduce, and they will continue to, those reproducing yeasts will continue to consume oxygen from your must, and you want to prolong that as long as possible. I'm a firm believer that either one of those approaches will make a lot better mead than what I, and really I became much more cognizant of that after I wrote the book. So the book says, just add a couple of teaspoons of DAP when you get started, and it's much more, you get a much higher quality fermentation if you do stagger your nutrient additions over the course of a few days, whether that's at a one-third sugar consumption point or staggered over the course of a few days. My approach is more of a just-in-time approach, as opposed to the let them eat a bunch and then sort of get them lean for a while and then feed them again.
So I think the trick here is to buy the book, donate to the Brewing Network,
yeah,
listen to the show, and you got all the current information, and you're ready to go.
Yeah, sounds good to me. A couple more questions. Did you talk about using malic acid to balance acidity? Someone asked if you would use that.
Malic acid is the traditional acid that you get from apples. It's one of the acids that you can use to add acidity. You can use citric, you can use tartaric, You can use a blend of all three of those. I've used them, I tend to use a blend, an acid blend myself. That's citric acid, citric malic and tartaric. And some people take an entirely different approach and use lemon juice. My inclination is to try and find a honey that's got a more balanced profile, if that's a, if that's an option. But if you find yourself in a situation where you've got a honey that, or a mead that's fermented out, if you're asking me what I would do, I would use an acid blend.
Okay. All right. Trying to get through all these for you, Ken. I know you got to go. A lot of questions came through for you. Someone asked about killing the yeast so that you don't get bottle bombs. So,
right.
Asked, hey, how do you kill the yeast without sulfites? Do you just rack lots of times or wait till it's settled out? They're just concerned about bottle bombs.
Well, if you're really concerned about bottle bombs, what you want to do is to get the yeast when they reach their alcohol tolerance and pretty much stop fermenting. And once the yeast has stopped fermenting, whether that's due to temperature changes or the fact that they run out of the nutrient, there's a sort of protein switch in the yeast that sort of stops itself from fermenting. And what you really want to have happen is that for that switch to never come back on again. And the trick to that is potassium sorbate. That's added at a level of half a teaspoon per gallon. And you want to add it when the yeast is not in an active fermentation. And then you will be assured that it will not create bottle bombs. You won't be able to bottle condition at that point. But if you're looking to have a still mead stay still, that's the trick.
Okay. Great.
And the great way to carbonate meads, put them in a keg, force carbonate them.
Absolutely. That's what I do.
You get great control and you can dial in exactly what you want, and you don't have to worry about the yeast or anything after that point.
I did have another question about bottle conditioning, though. Somebody asking if you could use honey to bottle condition. Could you add back honey as your sugar?
Yeah, you can. Okay. And just be aware that honey is about twice has twice the concentration of sugar per volume than your bottling sugar does. If you're using dextrose or if you're using maltose, so that if you're used to using a cup of priming sugar per 5-gallon batch, you would use a half a cup of honey.
Okay. All right, we're almost there. What do we look for in a good piment? Someone said they were even having trouble finding a good commercial example, and they don't know what to look for. What are the characteristics of a good piment?
The characteristics of a good piment are the characteristics of the good constituent ingredients. If you're really interested in crafting good piments, one of my first recommendations would be to find out what types of really good grapes or grape juice you can get in your area. I've had some great muscadine piments. The key is to find really high quality ingredients. And like I said earlier, I'm not sure you can find a commercial example of a great piment that's going to match the quality that you can make on your own.
Wow.
I'll give you the Michigan example. In Michigan, they do a pretty good job with growing some of the white grapes in the Traverse City area. They grow good Riesling, and so you find some place that will sell you 5 gallons of sulfited Riesling juice, and there are a few places in Michigan that will do that, and buy that, and then add honey to it up to the target gravity that you wanted to begin with. And work from there, and pick, like I said again, pick a honey that's gonna remain expressive and can kind of shout out its own character over the top of a really expressive grape character, and off you go. I think some of the white grapes, the Sauvignon Blancs, and the Rieslings, and Semillons, those are the kinds of grapes that if they have slightly higher acidity levels and lower Brix levels, that you can chaptalize with honey and make really nice piments.
Okay. All right, last questions for Ken, and then I got one for you, John, coming through. But I don't know if you guys covered fermentation temperatures.
No.
So a two-part question for you. Fermentation temperature, and then somebody also asked about aging temperatures.
Good questions.
Right. Well, I've got a Michigan cellar, so I'm very fortunate. And I can ferment. If I ferment in the cooler seasons, I can ferment at 55 degrees on my basement floor. But for those of you who are using freezers or other systems, the best recommendation that I would have is to go out to Lalamond or go to your the Lalamond website and or the folks from White Labs or the
More Beer.
Brother yeast supplier, and find out what their recommended fermentation temperature is, and try and match that. There is no magic of mead that says, oh well, it will ferment better as a mead at 70 than if Dave Logsdon or the White Labs is saying
Chris White,
no, 52 is where it's going to hit its sweet spot. Well, then ferment it at 52.
Okay. All right. Before the last question for John, a little bit of praise from the chat room for you, Ken. Somebody said, hey, tell Ken, I think this is a compliment. He says, tell Ken he stomps ass all day long. Tell him that honey making...
He's seen the video of you on YouTube.
He said, tell him that honey making its own hydrogen peroxide is the raddest shit I've ever heard in my life.
Glucose oxidase. Is that cool? I mean, that is just... totally cool. Bees and honey are absolutely magic stuff.
Yeah.
Well, and Ken, I will say, we don't do a lot of guests on here, but our previous best guest was actually Chris White of White Labs, who just
right.
did a rocking job, just kind of random staggering into the studio.
That's
but
cool.
I think you've been the best guest we've ever had.
Absolutely.
On the show, and I think the Sunday session needs to do a 3-hour segment with you to really kind of pick your brain and answer all these questions. And I think this has been wonderful. We wanted to have a great mead segment, and I think you've delivered for us. I really appreciate it.
I think this is an opportunity for the Brewing Network, a little Mead Strong. What do you think?
Yeah, we got to have Ken back for Mead Strong. Think so.
Wow. I appreciate it. You guys have been wonderful hosts.
All right.
So Jamil, Justin, John.
Cheers.
It's been my pleasure.
Great. Good job, Ken. I really appreciate it. We'll let you go to sleep. What is it? After 11 there, you got to get up early, huh?
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah. We're pushing here. It's been great. Thank you, Ken. Thank you to our sponsor, northernbrewer.com. You know, go on there. You can get honey from there. You can get the complete mead maker, which, again, just buy the book. It's really going to save you money in the long run. I did meads before I had the book. I did meads after I had the book. And I'm telling you, it's cheaper to just buy the book and then do your meads. You'll be much happier.
Oh, and someone asked if you cover braggots in the book, Ken.
Yes, I do, and
okay.
In fact, there are a couple of one of my award-making braggot recipes is in the book.
Okay,
I won a meet it. I won an award at Nationals with. So
nice.
Have at it.
All right. Thanks a lot, Ken. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you, John.
Thanks, Ken.
All right. I do have to do one last question for John.
Uh oh.
There's a rumor in the chat. Someone seems to remember an old story for you that you were telling.
Chicken flu.
Is it true that you got your lady with mead? Like, is that the one that sold her on to craft beer?
Or
that's how you got her to love
lady
you?
With the roofies,
there's some story that, from you, not from anyone else, that they're referencing about that's how you sealed the deal, or I don't know, something about mead and your lady.
Got her drunk.
Is this just a rumor?
Took advantage.
No,
and then she's like, well, I've been deflowered.
Someone will go back into the archives and find the clip, John. You better think.
It's all rumor.
No, John.
It was my dancing skills.
No, John, I think I recall something very similar.
Jamil, you want to see me salsa?
once we get our clothes off after this show, yeah.
Oh, yeah, wait till Saturday.
No.
Oh, yeah.
I think they're right.
I think
you mentioned that.
I seem to remember it.
I don't know.
Yeah.
It was,
You know the listeners. I'll tell you. That's amazing. In Australia, and this guy has me. He says, "Oh, sign the book. Brew that bad boy." I'm like, "Brew that bad boy." He goes, "Yeah, you say that all the time." I'm like, "Really?" He goes, "Yeah."
He's like,
and I thought
sorry.
About it for a moment. I go, "You know, you're right. I would say that sort of."
It did ring a bell for me too. Like it wasn't that that's how you met her, but it was.
Yeah,
it was something about that's where she accepted all that you
totally
do.
Right.
I don't know.
We got the best listeners of anybody who listens to podcasts. We got people that smart. They pay attention. They're focused. They have fun. They understand that we're drunk half the time.
Fair enough.
They know exactly what they're talking about. So I think you just have to accept it and say, "Come on,
you're right.
Come on."
Absolutely.
No. Give the true story. You got her drunk.
I'm drunk. I don't know.
Well, she's passed out. Let me drop some trowel. Let me drop her panties.
They were both high on meat. He doesn't remember.
You caught me in a lie.
All right. There's a lot of people in the chat. They're real excited about the final show coming up.
Oh, yeah. This is where the mayhem begins.
I think the meat show was excellent.
Absolutely.
Especially due to John Plisse and Ken Schramm. That was some quality broadcasting.
We're feeding off.
I drank and pretty much hung out. And I think the cider show will be pretty much crap, but we're going to have a lot of fun.
We're going to make it quality crap.
Quality crap. And if you've listened to us for the past 3 years, I don't know, maybe you'll cry along with us as we sing romantic ballads.
I've got it all planned out for you, Jamil. I've got it ready to go.
Damn!
Are you ready?
I totally lost track of what I was going to say for the close here. Yeah. I got all right.
Thank you to our sponsor.
Give me my 60 seconds, okay. Man. All right. Oh, thank you for listening for nearly 3 years. Be sure to go to northernbrewer.com and let them know that you heard about them from us and that you're buying because you enjoyed the programming that they've supported for 3 years. And support the Brewing Network, because otherwise this wouldn't have happened. And go to the Brewing Network store, brewingnetwork.com. And I don't know. I'm starting to get modeling here.
Yeah.
This has been a wonderful experience.
It's been awesome.
All right. And you've been wonderful listeners. And brew some meads. Really, brew some meads. You've got all
the
information.
Trials.
They'll turn out excellent if you follow Ken's instructions.
Buy 10 East.
All right. Brew strong.
Brew strong.